Hello and welcome to the Leadership Learned podcast, brought to you by the Inspirational Group. Each episode, we examine how leadership behaviors, skills, and attributes improve performance from the classroom to the boardroom. We discuss the latest issues, delve into the current thinking, and provide tangible insights as we go beyond the cliches to prove that leaders are made, not born. In this episode, Rona and I are joined by adventurer, author, and mental health advocate Alex Staniforth for a powerful conversation about resilience, what it really is, how to build it, and why it's so important in work, leadership, and life. Alex's journey isn't a simple tale of triumph over adversity. It's more complex and therefore much more real than that, because it's a story of some amazing triumphs amongst a lot of adversity. And that's exactly what makes it so valuable. His experience offers meaningful insights for anyone leading teams, managing change, or striving to create a healthier, more purpose-driven culture. Our conversation is rooted in the present, but future-focused. We talk in depth about the qualities that Alex's generation looks for in their leaders. Qualities he demonstrates in abundance: authenticity, a commitment to mental well-being, a strong sense of purpose, and many more. As such, this episode pairs perfectly with our recent white paper, which explores how Gen Z is redefining leadership and what organisations and leaders can do to engage, support, and connect with them. You can download it for free by following the link in the show notes. Alex was a great guest. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I'm sure you will too. In today's episode, we're talking to Alex Staniforth. Alex is a record-breaking adventurer, ultra-endurance athlete, keynote speaker, author, and founder of the mental health charity Mind Over Mountains. Despite suffering from many personal challenges since childhood, including epilepsy, stammering, depression, and anxiety, Alex has always refused to let those challenges become his identity. In 2017, he became the fastest person to climb all 100 UK county tops. He survived two of the most significant disasters in Mount Everest history, has received many awards for his charity work, and has written two books about his experiences. All that, and he's only just turned 29. Welcome, Alex.
Great to be here.
I'm also joined by podcast regular Dr. Rona McKenzie. Hello, Dr. Rona.
Hello. Thank you.
So, Alex, I wanted to start by talking about your background. And can you share a bit about your journey and what inspired you to take on such incredible challenges?
Sure. Yeah, thank you. When I look back now, you know, I had a very normal kind of start in life. I mean, it's an old cliche, but it's true that there was no obvious sign or thirst for adventure. I was brought up in Chester, not a lot of mountains in Chester, and it was fairly comfortable. And you don't really build resilience by being comfortable. I think what changed was when I was about 9, I had epilepsy. And although that was a very mild form, it was soon brought under control. But actually what that did was kind of be the catalyst for a whole host of different challenges. So it triggered anxiety and panic attacks. And that made the world a very scary place to be at such a young age, when you're just trying to fit in and to find yourself and to be accepted. I've had a stammer all my life, which comes and goes when it likes, you know, just turns up to social events with no real purpose and gets on everybody's nerves. And didn't help the whole situation in terms of my confidence and my self-esteem and all the bullying. And I've always struggled with words, being with C and K, which isn't ideal when you're from Kelsall and now live in Kendal. And then on top of that, I've also hated sport all my life. So it wasn't like I was born with this natural ability to be an athlete or to run or climb mountains at all. I guess the inspiration came from the fact that I, for a long time, was stuck in this victim mindset, you know, and reinforcing that kind of narrative and thinking that I wasn't good enough, there was something wrong with me. And when I was about 14, I found the outdoors by chance. And there was a few things, but one of the key moments was my first hill walk in the Lake District. And that was just a complete mindset shift. It blew my mind, because the first time I realized that actually I could overcome things, I could achieve things, and actually all of these setbacks didn't have to stop me achieving my full potential. And so that was when I found the path. I found a way to really be my best self. And I decided I wasn't going to let these challenges stop me anymore. So that's really where the inspiration and the initial drive and motivation came from is my childhood. Like a lot of people, that's the foundation, and that's where you start from.
And what has given, what in particular has inspired you to do the challenges that you have done? You know, the mountaineering and the racing, that kind of thing.
I think initially it was just that perception where a challenge was just me versus the environment. Like I wasn't looking for approval. It wasn't about what the bullies thought about me. It was just something where my direct effort and ability and mindset and skill was the result of me achieving that goal. I think in doing so, then boosted my confidence, my self-worth, my self-esteem that I never had before. And so it was pretty much a, you know, it was pretty much a guaranteed equation where, you know, myself and this mountain can achieve something, and therefore, you know, nobody could take that away from me, if that makes sense. And ultimately, I think initially, as a teenager, it was a bit about trying to prove the bullies wrong. It was trying to prove myself wrong. And in the mountains, there was that escape, there was that freedom, and just that realization that I had a choice, you know, and that actually it didn't have to be this way, and it was a chance to create a new future for myself and to do more and more things. And it's a classic thing when somebody, you know, somebody will do a marathon and they'll say, I'm never going to do that again. And then a week later, they've booked another marathon. You know, you kind of have to incrementally raise the bar and raise the bar and try and find the next big thing. And for a long time, it was that. It was about trying to raise the bar and then getting that fix and then needing more and more and more. There was a bit of a shift in that as I got older, and I realized that that kind of approach to success and to life wasn't very sustainable. But initially, it was that. And I think after Everest went a bit pear-shaped, I realized I could find the same challenge, the same satisfaction and the fulfillment that I could from Everest in challenges in the UK and ultra running. And my mum was very pleased with that approach as well. So I stayed obviously, you know, nearer to home, where it was literally just a case of myself and my ability to keep putting one foot in front of the other, rather than, you know, avalanches and weather and Sherpas and everything, all these things that are outside of my control. But the mountains are just where I kind of practice my religion. I wouldn't really call myself a mountaineer or anything. That just happens to be where I find my challenges.
And potentially one of the biggest, I would say, achievements for you is the fact that you do suffer from this stammer, and yet you make your living as a motivational speaker, as an inspirational speaker. And what was that must have been such a huge thing for you to do. What motivated you to do that?
Yeah, not your most conventional job title when you've had a stammer all your life. I
No.
mean, to give an example of that, so I've just come back from speaking at a conference in Eindhoven at the weekend, to 200 people at the EMCC, because I speak a lot in corporates, but also at conferences and organizations and schools around resilience and mindset and mental health. And on the flight home, I was really tired. You know, I've had a really big week. I had three big events, not a lot of sleep. And I wanted a coffee, and they came round on the trolley service. And because it's a C word, they asked me, "Would you like a drink?" And I knew I wanted a coffee, but I couldn't say it. And I didn't want tea because I want the proper stuff. And I just couldn't say it. And I was like getting blocks and slurring my words because I tend to avoid words that I struggle with, which is a problem when you need to say your name. And after various attempts of trying to control my breathing and say I wanted a coffee, I just gave up. I put my headphones back in and just went back to sleep. And then they came back shortly afterwards, and they were kind of the chief flight attendant was there, and they were checking me for signs of a stroke. They thought I was having a stroke because I couldn't speak.
Oh
And
no.
obviously, I was fine. I can't fault their customer service, but that's the irony, having spoken, you know, as being the closing keynote speaker just the day earlier. And then on a day-to-day basis, I have this. To answer your question, because that just gives it a bit of context as to what it's like. When I carried the Olympic torch in 2012, which was a massive honor, which was the result of my early fundraising, my old primary school asked me to go and speak to the kids. And my first thought was, I can't do that. I can't even ask for a bus ticket. You know, like, don't be daft. That was my worst nightmare. You know, I used to hide in toilets at school because I was so scared of having to read something out in class. But having had that experience of the torch, I started saying yes to things and started to realize that actually, when I did scary things, good things happened as a result. And so I said yes, and I didn't sleep for weeks and weeks, but I did it. And actually, I found that speaking to 200 kids who or the most unforgiving audience you could ever get. Give me, you know, give me 100 senior, like, you know, kind of C-suite any day, honestly. And I found that actually I was a lot more fluent speaking in front of people than I was on the phone or on a conversation.
Oh, wow.
And I got a massive kick out of that. And I remember getting emails from parents, you know, saying how much it had really inspired their kids and how their kid had been running around the garden with a coat hanger above their head, pretending to be like Alex with the Olympic torch, you know. And it was that kind of realization of actually, I could inspire people. This is really cool. And you know, that impact piece, that was my motivation for doing it. And not only was it helping me to overcome my challenges, but actually it could help other people who had the same thing. And you know, doing talks at schools where kids had stammers and hadn't heard anybody with a stammer before. I did a talk fairly recently in a business, and even then there was a young colleague who had a stammer and had never heard anybody with a stammer before. And it had just given him so much motivation and confidence in what was possible.
Mm.
That's why I do it, you know, and I still struggle with it. You know, I struggle more with the fact that when I'm having a briefing call, I'm trying to be taken seriously, and yet I'm trying to prove to them that I'm going to be fine when I'm on stage. And if I stammer on stage, it's part of the story. It's part of me. So I'm not going to hide it. I can't hide it.
Mm.
There's so much in there that I'd love to ask you about in terms of that ability to be vulnerable. But before that, your desire to inspire so many, whilst you make that look really easy, I would imagine that internally that might not feel as easy as it looks. How do you do it?
In terms of that desire to inspire, I think it just feels natural. Mm. And the challenging part about it is just not knowing when you've done it. Like when you do a keynote or a talk and you don't get any feedback and you think, have I added any value here? Have I made any difference? And then you get those little golden nugget emails that come a week or a few days later and you don't expect them. And then you think, actually, if I've reached one person and caused a shift for them, then it's worth it. But to be honest, it feels like the right thing to do, and therefore it's not difficult, you know, mm-hmm. because it just happens by default. And I think the only challenging part about it is when I don't feel like that's happening, really,
mm-hmm.
Because you can't always measure when that happens to people. It might be a seed that you plant in their mind that doesn't grow for a few years down the line until the circumstances are right. Another challenge that maybe just that's come to mind with that is that, you know, if you always feel the need to be valuable, to do something, to make a difference, then it can be quite a bit of a treadmill at times. And sometimes it can be a bit of a kind of a sacrificial thing, rather than just being content, just being myself and just being me. You know, I don't always have to be giving something back, but it just feels like the right thing to do. And therefore it's when it's entrenching your purpose, it's hard not to fulfill that. And I'm very lucky that my speaking work and charity and everything I do, it has this kind of nice ecosystem where it not only allows me to follow my own goals, but actually to fulfill that purpose and give something back and bring all these things together. You know, it's just when that ecosystem is unbalanced, things can go a bit wrong sometimes.
I was interested you said earlier around the challenges building kind of and taking you to Nepal and taking you to some dangerous places, and your ability to almost regroup and consider what challenge means to you and what it might look like. Was there anything in particular that led you to come to that conclusion?
I think after Everest 2015, with the earthquake on the second year and the avalanche the year before, you know, the two biggest disasters in Everest history, and then having survived that at 19 and having had that, you know, fairly near-death experience at such a young age, gave me a real perspective as to what's important in life and realizing how fragile life is, and that kind of questioning myself, like, had I been in base camp that morning, had I not left base camp through the ice fall to the relative safety of camp one, what would I have left behind? And it's almost that like midlife crisis moment, but at a very early age, and that sense of like needing to leave something behind and have a legacy. And I think that's when I started to think, am I really making the biggest impact by just climbing big mountains on my own halfway across the world? And obviously I'm not on my own because I've got a team around me, but you know, I'm not bringing people on the journey too. And so that was when I started to kind of question, like, what's this all for? You know, and when we spoke before around what kind of motivated my challenges, it's I think for a long time, it was about kind of self-worth, and it was about proving people wrong and proving the bullies wrong. But that's not a sustainable source of motivation, because you always need more and more and more and more, and you're always chasing the next big thing. And it was like, what can I create that can make a bigger impact? And I remember going back to the Himalayas in 2016 on Chowayu, which is the sixth highest peak in the world. And once again, I didn't climb that either. And having this like light bulb moment where I just looked out across to Everest and just had this sense of closure, like there was nothing there. There was no feeling, there was no drive, there was no goosebumps. And that sense of just letting go. And I think that was when I started to realize that I could do other things that weren't just about the outcome. You know, so much was about the outcome. Like when I reach the top, when I finish the marathon this time, I will be successful. I think success is really more about the journey and the process and that difference. And sure, I still need the goals and runs and distances, but that's not the only outcome now.
So interesting to hear you say that, and at such a young age to have realized that what many of us work out when we're in our 40s and 50s, that we've been chasing the next promotion or the next opportunity. And as you just said, that classic of when I get to X, I'll be satisfied or happy, or and we keep chasing to a point whereby most of our life's vanished in front of our eyes and we wonder what we missed in the process. But it feels like your purpose has always been, you've always been true to your purpose, but your way of meeting it, for want of a better phrase, has changed. So you're still you and doing what you love. You've re-engineered what that looks like, so it's more meaningful for you and your life and for those people that you come into contact with. That's there's How do you share that with people so they can do that quicker? So they're not 30s, 40s, 50s realizing.
Really good question. And I guess my process was turbocharged by the avalanche. And, you know, having those moments really makes you think about what's important, you know. And I obviously would not recommend people go and find themselves on an avalanche on Everest. But I do feel grateful for that, not because of course the death and the suffering and losing our teammates. You know, I'd give anything to be there instead. But it's, you know, those things happen and it wasn't expected. But I do think we can ask ourselves those same questions. And I think when we're not aligned with our purpose and our goals, then it just doesn't feel right. And I think when I think of my mental health battles, like it's often been when I've lost that sense of purpose and I've not known what I'm getting out of bed for, and I'm not feeling like I'm making progress. And I think just people scheduling time to really ask themselves those questions and be really honest and make scary changes can often have the same transformation, you know. And the sad thing is we often do wait for a long time until things get really, really, really bad, or till we hit kind of rock bottom before we get that kind of kick up the backside to actually change something. And the avalanche did that for me. But ultimately, I think by challenging ourselves, we learn so much about ourselves. And, you know, it doesn't have to be the extreme ways. It could be the, you know, the moving to a new area. It could be stopping things that don't serve us. It could be, you know, to let go, to move, to get new roles, to all these things. I think we are able to work out what's important to us. And I think if you have that as a guiding principle, I think generally you can't go too far wrong. And if you do, you could kind of get yourself back on track. So I would say to obviously challenge ourselves, you know, in any small ways, but spend time, go away on a solo trip. That's the best way to think about these things, is to be on your own in the mountains. You get this clarity of thought like nowhere else.
I think
Sorry, Matt.
No, I was just going to say, talking that whilst we're talking about purpose and the things that you've said there, I think a lot of the time it's actually taking the time to stop and explicitly think about what is motivating me here. And then from a business perspective, thinking, you know, as from a, well, from a leader's perspective, thinking about what's motivating my team here during these bits as well. And we quite often don't do that. And although we don't necessarily always have the opportunity to go away to a mountain, you can make time to sit down and think about it.
I mean, I have less experience of that context. You know, a lot of these challenges and goals have been kind of solo missions. In the charity, it's been really interesting for me because I've been learning how to, you know, work around that as a team as well, and realize that actually I'm not just going to think about my own values here, but everyone else's and how that works. But yeah, we're just busy. We don't take stop time to step off and just check, are we on the right mountain here? You know, And I think what I realized a lot on Everest was how we're all there to achieve the same goal, but we're all there for different reasons. And when there was conflict in the base camp tent, I say conflict, you know, just disagreements and kind of what happens when you put people in a tent at 5,500 meters for 3 weeks with no showers. That really surprised me because you'd think that everybody has the best interests at heart, but actually everyone's kind of there for their own thing. And yeah, and I said I've never had kind of a conventional job, so I've not had to sit down with a team before. And in the charity, I've really learned a lot from that whole process as well.
But you mentioned their high pressure environments, and what would you say leaders can do to support their team's mental health in when they're in high pressure environments like that?
I think back to Everest again, and I know it's an extreme example, but I think it can apply anywhere. You know, is when we were stuck up at Camp One for 2 days. You know, we had no idea how long we were going to be there. We're at over 6,000 meters. We're camping high at the top of Kilimanjaro. The route down to base camp's gone. We've got food for a day or 2 days at most, so it's a bit of a pickle. And just that sense of focusing on the controllables, and actually Tim, our leader, coming around just saying, right, keep the stoves on, keep the brews going, keep your heads down, and just about taking care of ourselves and taking care of each other. Just get the basics right. And if you get the basics right, you kind of can't go too far wrong. But also, I think it's about vulnerability and actually not always knowing all the answers. And, for Tim, I mean, Tim had no idea what was going to happen. And our leader, who we looked to, couldn't pretend or say anything because he didn't know. And I think just for that, then it made us trust more, but also realize that we're all in this together. We all have to play a part in this. But I think what leaders can do from a mental health basis is actually to share how they're feeling, to lead by example. And I think when you do that, other people feel able to open up to share too. And therefore you have that shared experience. You realize you're not the only one. And I think when people do that, you build a much more cohesive and open team. And then you almost create what I call this positive multiplier effect, where other people start putting their hand up and then it spreads quite quickly. So yeah, just creating the space and psychological safety just by being open themselves when they're struggling, when they're a bit scared, and creating a space for people to do that, I think is the best thing everyone can do. Everyone has their own kind of coping tools, and just a reminder sometimes to stay in the present, because I find that when I'm most stressed and anxious, I'm worrying about things that haven't even happened yet. And the people around us can just pull us back in and just say, hang on a minute, this is what we need to do. So I guess a few of those things put together, perhaps.
And what advice would you give to leaders about setting and achieving ambitious goals, but also managing any setbacks that do come along?
I guess it also depends a lot on the goals. My mantra is always to kind of throw myself in the deep end and learn to swim. But I appreciate that it's hard to do that when there's people's jobs and income and money and stakeholders at stake. But I think you've got to expect setbacks. Like if it's an ambitious goal, then you're going to have setbacks. If it was an easy goal, then are you really going to be gaining much from that or growing and achieving your full potential if there's an easy path with no barriers or kind of curveballs? So I think when you expect setbacks, they don't stress you out or challenge you as much because you're prepared for them. You accept that they are part of that process. I think secondly, it's I think commitment is often the difference between success and failure. Like I've often said, if you really want it, you'll find a way. Either find a way or make one. And with Everest, like I think back to that, I was having to raise £35,000 just in corporate sponsorship, just to pay for the trip when I was 18. I was doing my A levels at the time. My parents weren't going to pay for it. I was washing pots in the local kitchen. That wasn't going to pay for it. My dad said that's a lot of money for a holiday, but he wouldn't say that because I'm from Yorkshire. So I was literally having to find a way to make one. And I think the difference was just being fully committed. Like it was a case of I will rather than I'll try. And I think if you're fully committed, you won't look for a way out. You have that problem-solving mindset. And I see this all the time. And I think like the people that got to Everest before me, who I asked for advice and who I reached out to, Everest became their life because it had to be. Nothing else really mattered. And my whole life for a whole year revolved around one question, and that's, will this get me to Everest? So I think being fully committed is key, but also it's knowing your why, having the end in mind. And with every challenge, I have to do a bit of brainstorming before I kind of have that vision of the finish line.
So interesting hearing you say that. That purpose piece is so strong. And clearly, you know, when you're with your team, whether it be on Everest or going coast to coast, that the team's aligned to the same purpose. So we're all working towards the same goal and we have different responsibilities and the different parts we play. But equally, together, we're stronger and we'll get there. So I'm imagining the adversity you face in Everest. There's adversity everywhere. It's how quickly can you assess the challenge and replan? I guess you've got quite good at that, given the work that you do.
Yeah, I think with planning in advance for challenges, like I'm actually fairly laid back. Everything I can control, I've done to a pretty, you know, a pretty decent ability. But I don't plan much more beyond that because I know so much is going to change when I hit start on my watch. I always just have an approach and a mindset that I'll just adapt as I go and I'll deal with what happens. Because I think back to the Three Peaks run back in 2020 when I sprained my ankle about a week before I was due to start. And this is before trying to run, you know, 50 miles a day for 9 days in a row. And I saw three physios and they all said to me, you know, you're going to have much bigger things to worry about than a sprained ankle. And as it happens, they were right. And the ankle was actually fine. The things that really, really stumped me were things I didn't even plan for, didn't even write down as a possible scenario. So some people would disagree with that. And you can scenario plan everything. But I just have a mindset that I'll just deal with whatever happens. And you know, I think it's in those moments where things have gone wrong and you're panicking and stressed and, you know, it's all going pear-shaped is trying to be kind of proactive rather than in a reactive state and taking some time out not to make decisions when you're stressed and you're emotional because you don't make good decisions. And also, more importantly, having a team around you to have a second perspective, because when you're tired and knackered, often you lose sight of the bigger picture. You know, and I've had friends come at just the right moment on challenges, and without them I wouldn't have finished. But I am fairly laid back, as some people may vouch for that and comment on as well.
I love that, particularly that thought of, you know, those fresh perspectives that we need. We can take that tiredness, whether we're tired in a physical challenge, tired with a work problem that's kind of emerged and we're not sure which way to go. And it resonates with me that when the going gets tough, my focus can narrow and I can start to look kind of down rather than up and out. And having, as you say, those people that have a different perspective, ask different questions or have different kind of solutions. Being open-minded, it sounds as if you are very reflective, very open-minded, very honest and kind of open about how you feel. But that your ability to reflect seems to be important in the work that you're doing and the challenges that you're kind of overcoming, both, well, everywhere and everything that you're doing.
I think being reflective is something I do, but a lot of it is now looking back at it now from, you know, the benefit of a few years ago or months in the moment. I can get quite flustered and stressed. And, you know, it's hard to reflect when you haven't got long between the thing that's just happened and you're kind of bothered by it. But it's easy to think back a few years later and then learn from it. And then I've learned from that for the next time it happens. And I look at my approach to my challenges now and my approaches to years and years ago. And I would say I am more relaxed now because I know a lot of the things I worry about won't happen. I mean, there was a study recently that 85% of what we actually worry about never even happens, which is quite interesting. But yes, reflective, I think having a clear why in mind, you know, having a main effort, as my old coach, you know, he used to say, was, you know, what's the main effort? And John always said that to me and it always stayed with me. And I think having that in mind, you can kind of just, you know, actually fall back on that. Mm-hmm. And it's much easier then to say no and to say yes to things that we need to do. But again, I think that reflection comes from experience. So people say, well, how do I get started? I think you kind of have to learn and suffer and fail a bit to get that insight, unfortunately. There is no shortcut to this stuff.
Sorry, Matt.
Sorry, I know I was going to say, I mean, you obviously are, as we sit here now, you are a very resilient person. But is that something that, and I think you've just answered this in many ways, but is that something that you've learned, or do you think there was a degree of it that you had naturally anyway?
Great question. And I think resilience is not something that we have or don't have. I think it's a skill that we have to develop. And I think challenge builds resilience, and that's if you look at a lot of the like ultra high performers and top athletes, which I don't class myself as at all, a lot of them have had some major trauma in their childhood or their life that gives them that edge, that ability to suffer, to keep going, than other people don't have. And it's interesting, especially in schools, a lot of the schools in like deprived areas, the kids are there dealing with a lot of challenges. Actually, if they can capture that, they actually have a resilience that perhaps other students wouldn't have. And I think what happened to me in my childhood could have gone a number of ways, but because of the way I went, perhaps not by choice, but just by kind of following my nose and seeing where it took me, has developed a resilience. But what I've realized is it's not universal, and it's something that ebbs and flows. And we all have times when we're more or less resilient because of what's happening in our lives and when we don't manage stress. And I think mental health and resilience are very closely linked. And I think when we are more resilient, we can better deal with stress and life events that otherwise may lead to depression or anxiety, for example. But equally, we can't be resilient if we're not taking care of our mental health. And I think back of a number of low points and kind of burnout points in my life where I've not been resilient at all. So it's still possible to be broken by different stresses or just to be overwhelmed. But I do think now that with that comes self-awareness, and the more self-aware you are, the better you can respond to things that would kind of break us. When you've been in Nepal and been in the earthquake, it's just perspective, really. But it doesn't mean I don't have a good moan. We all have that now and again. We're all human.
You mentioned that you go and talk to students in schools, and I'm curious, when you look back on kind of your younger self, is there particular advice that you give the students or lessons that you've learned that you think are important for them to hear?
Don't climb Everest and you get there. No, don't do any can. I mean, bullying was a big part of my childhood. No, I don't think many kids escape it at all. I'm not the only one at all. And I was, I think the real sad thing about bullying is often people become bullies as a result of that, to try and almost keep themselves safe, and it was a really rough time. The advice I'd give to myself back then would be, nobody can make you feel anything. Like almost all these words and things that used to be cool, that used to cause me so much stress because I let them cause me stress. Because at 13, 14, 15, you don't know any better, you don't know any different. And I look back now and the bullies are exactly where I thought they'd be, and I think I just wish I'd had the confidence to trust myself rather than to let my worth be defined by other people. That's what I'd say. But also, I think it's that fear of failure, that fear of things going wrong. I think I do see this a lot, is that there is this massive focus on success. In school, we're not taught how to fail. We're taught that failure is a bad thing. Failure is just a chance to go on and do more bigger things. And it's part of the process. And we've tried to sort of separate the two. So that's the advice I would give. But I think so much of this, I think, is triggered by this need to fit in and be accepted. And I think if young people are able to find themselves and what matters to them, then they would be a lot happier. And I think we'd be seeing a lot less of the mental health challenges we're seeing in young people, which is triggered by this kind of mental health mirror on social media. That's a few things I've seen, but I mean, I left school, what, more than 10 years ago now, so.
Yeah, bit more recently than me, though. I find it really interesting because when we talk about adults of all ages and their experience in life and making the most of it, we often say that we need to know ourselves first, and we need to know what really motivates us, what is our purpose, and how do we show up in the world that we live in? How do we see it through our own eyes? Because it was different to everybody else, because our life experiences are so different, and that as characters we are all very different. So once we get to know ourselves a little more and work out where we're heading and why we think we'd like to go there and why that differs to other people, then we can start to, yeah, as you say, forge our own path. And that comparison is the thief of joy, as they say. It's so tricky. Someone once said to me that some great advice. He said, "You can't change anyone else's behavior, only your own." And I got that advice when I was probably in my early 30s, and it was a game changer for me because it reminded me that, as you say, I can choose how I respond. I can choose how I feel about something, even though sometimes we might disagree with that. It is the truth. And also we can then choose how we respond, what we do next. That takes almost the pressure away from trying to change someone else, actually just being who we are. And yeah, getting that feedback from not having success rather than the failure word. Feedback is so good.
I listened to a podcast on this recently about, you know, all the things that we can control in life. And often two things we can control is our mindset and how hard we work on things. And after Everest, that was my initial realization is, you know, I was so scared of failure because I thought if I worked hard enough, I couldn't fail. Actually, there's a lot of things outside of my hands. But it's only a failure if you stop there. And I think often we try to do things because of whether people are going to like them. You know, well, what about if we like them? What if we like the shirt that would, you know, we have on, or the song or the talk? And this is a real challenge with speaking, is that, you know, I have to accept that if I'm speaking to 200 people, not all of them are going to like the talk. That's not really possible, I don't think. And it is hard because that's almost a reflection on you, because I am the story. I am kind of what I'm talking about. But actually, like, then I think of myself, my opinions, well, I don't like everything. And it's not possible to do that. And we seem to be doing things to try and fit in and be accepted rather than actually do accept ourselves. You know, who cares if they don't like it? You know, but I do. And it's not about being arrogant about it, but it's just about knowing ourselves and spending our energy where we make our biggest impact, I think.
And I was going to ask, actually, Rona, from your perspective, you know, we've been talking about this resilience and the mental health aspect of things with young people. What are the things that people can, that schools and education and authorities and things can do about that sort of thing, you know, beyond the throwing a blanket over them and wrapping them in cotton wool? And is it this know yourself thing and helping them with that?
In schools are busy places. There's so much to do, so little time. And often our focus is on that achievement piece that Alex talked about earlier. We're looking for the next certificate, the next goal, help children prepare for their futures. And that seems to be as if we're on a bit of a hamster wheel. It's a trajectory to next job, next course. And actually being able to stop the clock, whether we're 14 or 44, that moment of stopping the clock and thinking about why are we here and what are we doing? And in education, it feels like it's about giving the children the chance to say, why am I here? What does school give to me? What is going to be in my life? And I don't need to know now, because it doesn't need to be the truth and the truth forever. It's just that ability to stop and think about themselves. You say, who am I? Why am I here? What am I enjoying? What am I curious about? Where might I like to go next? What did I experience and what worked and what didn't? And let me learn and grow from that in that really safe way. And because we know schools don't get much time to do that, to stop the clock and do it, I really believe that teachers need to be supported to learn to become coaches so that in their natural language, in the corridors or the classrooms or wherever, at playgrounds at lunchtime and whenever, there's a chance to ask those really nice big questions that get kids talking and thinking, and encourage young people to learn to coach one another. And it doesn't need to sound as formal as coaching. It's genuinely being curious about what someone else is thinking and asking them some nice open questions to let them think out loud. Because the more we talk, it's almost a bit like Alex is going into the mountains and having your quiet time. If your internal voice asks great questions, you can work all sorts of things out. But if you've never had that before, it can get a bit stuck. So those times are really valuable in schools. And I recognize that they're not rich with time. So developing other ways to get kids talking be super helpful.
I think just to add to that, I mean, having been coached from a fairly young age with Everest, you know, Chris was my first coach and mentor. But when I look back, it was definitely more coaching. I've seen firsthand just how transformational that was. And again, asking the right questions, not giving me the answers like a teacher would, but actually asking me the questions to almost work out the answers for myself. And then you think, oh, well, I've come up with this. And that builds so much confidence and trust in yourself. With Everest, you know, with raising money, meeting Chris at the right time was probably the difference between me getting there and not getting there, quite literally. And Chris and I actually started the charity 4 years ago. So it obviously shows us the power of a coaching question. And, you know, there's early questions, as you say, to get people curious. I mean, it's so different to teaching. It still has a massive impact on lives, but completely agree with that. Completely agree with just the power of questions.
So you mentioned your charity there. We've touched on it a couple of times. Can you tell us more about it and why you started it in the first place?
Yeah, so Mind Over Mountains kind of came really off the back of my own experiences with, you know, poor mental health. And again, I've been fairly lucky that I've always functioned pretty well, but you know, I had depression for the first time when I was 16. I've had a few bouts of that throughout the years. Anxiety is a pretty common thing for me. I had an eating disorder for 8 years, bulimia, which came off the back of an injury. So I've had all these things kind of going on. And I've always used the outdoors as my therapy. Like getting running or cycling or in the mountains has always generally helped me to cope fairly well. There's been times when I haven't, you know, after Everest was one of those, when I was on medication and things like that. And what I realize is, you know, the outdoors is not a miracle cure, but it's about a tool. And I think our approach to mental health can be very reactive rather than proactive. It's not something we work on, we try and sort of fix and deal with. And so off the back of Everest, I came up with a challenge called Climb the UK, which you mentioned at the start, which is around, you know, climbing the highest point of all 100 counties by human power. And that was kind of my new Everest. But what struck me from that was it took me longer to get the help I needed to get an appointment for my depression and my eating disorder as a young man than it did to, you know, travel 5,000 miles around the country.
Wow.
And that obviously wasn't good enough. You know, and I thought, well, what about everyone else that hasn't got the access to the outdoors and that kind of breathing space that I had? So back to the piece before around being open and being vulnerable. And having started to talk openly about my own mental health for the first time, you know, on my blog and my talks, realizing that by doing so, I could help other people. I then got approached to lead an event in the Lake District, which is all around promoting the outdoors for mental health. And so I contacted Chris, my coach, who's a qualified coach and counselor. And we designed this weekend retreat of coaching, walking, mindfulness, counseling, and inspirational speakers. So it's like holistic package, basically, but on a mountain. And we were so blown away by the impact that had that, you know, we thought we had to do more of this. And that kind of approach and model was, and still is, the framework for our charity, but doing it on day walks, on weekend retreats, doing it for people in the general public, anybody over 18, also a lot with emergency services, you know, blue light workers, paramedics, the police, the College of Paramedics, and also corporate teams, you know, because high levels of burnout and, you know, bringing people back together again, we work in a whole different range of places. The charity has grown very quickly. You know, we now work all over England and Wales. And so, yeah, that's where it came from, is essentially having this kind of natural health service, which I call it, and trying to help more people access that. And the charity now underpins like everything I do. You know, it all feeds back into that kind of big vision. But this is where I've had to learn about a lot about working in teams and being a leader, is actually you've got to, if a vision is literally held by you alone, your impact's going to be so limited. You've got to empower people with a vision to really make things happen. So recently I've had to like hand it over to, you know, our team and our CEO, Ian, who joined us last year, you know, and they make the thing happen and they make a far, far bigger impact than I could ever do on my own.
I love that phrase, natural health service, as well.
So do
That's
I.
brilliant. But and I wonder how leaders within their own organizations can use those similar principles themselves.
I mean, we'd love to support them, but I think they can easily take one or more of those elements. You know, I think, you know, what one thing we often use is this ethos that, you know, we're not there to fix people. We're just there to offer a safe space to listen, to understand without pressure, without expectation, without judgment. We all have people in our lives trying to fix us because they care. But actually, sometimes that's not very helpful. And we just say to people at the very start, you know, we're not there to fix, we're just there to listen. And that's one thing I think people can do, is not always have to be productive trying to offer solutions, just create a safe space to understand and try and empathize if, as you say, how people are thinking and be curious. We've always found that by something about being in the open environment, walking side by side, that makes it easier to talk about things because you haven't got the eye contact or you're looking for that emotional reaction, especially for men who don't like to show their emotions as much. So obviously when we're having the coaching process, you know, you're walking side by side, you're not like sat face to face in a boardroom, for example. So that's something that people can do, is just by changing your environment, you create these open conversations. Mindfulness is something we teach because people can take that into their meetings, into the busy train journey, you know, when they're feeling anxious. It can be something we practice all the time. You know, it's easy to do on a hillside when you're looking out into the distance, but then it can just be a few moments every day just to ground ourselves, to bring ourselves back into the present. So this is just a few things, you know, obviously getting the team out walking, doing obviously walking meetings is not a new idea. It's a classic now, but some of those components, I think, can really bring people together.
I think it's a really useful reminder because often we forget the little things. So sometimes I feel businesses make the mistake of thinking, I've got to stop the clock and take everyone away for 3 days to an entirely different place and do fun team building activities or just go and have fun. And it's like, yeah, and then we have to go back to work. And if we've not thought about what wasn't quite right before, well, absence won't fix it. So as you say, those smaller things of going for a walk to meet, exactly as you say, not eyeballing one another, having the time to stop, so much could be done. I also recognize that by coming away with, such as with the charity, you get the chance to stop the clock and reflect and engage in something that's planned and thoughtful and constructive and leads on to doing differently when they get back. And there's real value in that. Little tricks, well, not tricks, but little things we can do, and also the big things at the right time.
Apologies. This is just to add that I think exactly that, Rona. It is about habits. It's about regular things consistently rather than massive big tick boxes, which I think often is sadly the case.
Yeah.
And I think that going to a different environment, you know, like you said, Rona, it doesn't necessarily have to be a massive, big, you know, we're going for three days on a team building exercise, but also just if you've got to have the mentality that if you move out of the space that you're always in, you're going to potentially get a different outcome as well. And it doesn't have to be a huge change, but just going somewhere different, you know, as opposed to, we're going to have a brainstorming meeting in the office, in the chair that you're always in. And but particularly in this day and age as well, with the remote working, you know, it's coming together potentially. That's the new environment. You know, we're not all going to be on a Zoom or Teams call. We're going to actually be sat in a room together or going on a walk together. One thing I did want to ask you as well is, we talk a lot about inspirational leadership and inspirational stories. On our Monday morning meetings, we always start with them. And I wonder if you have any particular stories from your adventures that sort of had a massive impact on your leadership and resilience.
Interestingly, because I've never really kind of classed myself as a leader. I didn't really understand what it was until fairly recently. But I think if I look back at it now, a couple of key moments were, again, on Everest, because it's naturally where I think I could think of most, was after the earthquake, going to stay with our Sherpa friends, Tashi and Lapka, in their tea house. And they had, you know, they had a massive crack down the front wall. Fortunately, they were, you know, unharmed. And it was that hospitality that they had. So, you know, despite they were the victims, not us, the ability to kind of keep being resilient by actually focusing on what they have rather than what they lack, and by giving more, let me take. But then in 2017, I went back to see them about 2 years later, just to go and see how Nepal had, you know, had rebuilt after the earthquake. And tragically, a few days before, their tea house had burnt down in a freak fire. And again, they were unharmed, but they'd lost pretty much everything. And I got there and not knowing really what to say, you know, and Lapa just came over, his arms in the air, smiling, saying, don't worry, it's okay. We're going to build a better house. This one was rubbish. And how would we react if that was our house? I mean, for me, it was that real moment of like, this is why they're so resilient, because they always find the opportunity in the worst possible situations. And like, I've never forgotten that. I mean, obviously experiencing the earthquake and the avalanche and the disruption of that has had a massive impact on my leadership, because it's made me realize just how, you know, staying at base camp can be the biggest risk of all. You know, we think staying at base camp in our comfort zone is the safest place to be, but the actual reality of that situation was not taking the risk, not taking that first step across the ice fall, which is the most dangerous place on the mountain, actually would have killed us. And that's what gives me this capacity for risk now, is realizing that actually that a lot of the things we're afraid of, we haven't even seen yet, you know. So I guess I'll give you two stories there.
Love that first story.
They are remarkable. They really are the most resilient people I've ever met.
So I've just got a couple more questions. First of all, I just was wondering, with your personal achievements and the physical challenges that you've done, the charity work and everything, what is it that you're most proud of?
Oh, blimey, this is a very kind of vain question to answer. You know, I think the thing I'm probably most proud of is starting the charity, because it's bigger than me. Like, it's not it's already much bigger than me, and it's going to make a bigger difference than even when I'm not here, you know. And that's the thing, is like, it's just about leaving something bigger behind. And the second, probably my Pride of Britain award, which is downstairs on the mantelpiece, you know, that was off the back of my Climb the UK challenge. And to get that recognition just meant the world to me. Getting in, and finally, getting on Lad Bible for positive reasons is probably up there as well. After my three piece run. So I just thought I'd drop that in as well.
Brilliant. And what does the future hold, apart from obviously, getting mentioned on Lad Bible a couple more times?
Good question. What's next? Always the classic question for a, you know, an outdoors person. People always want to know what the next challenge is. So I think with the charity, we've got a campaign called Project 500, which we started last year. And the campaign idea really is about trying to raise £500,000 by June this year, which is my 30th birthday. Not because I like birthdays, I want to celebrate it, more to highlight just the current state around, you know, mental health and young people, and to really highlight the fact that now suicide is the biggest killer of people under 35 in the UK. You know, every day
Wow.
five young people take their lives by suicide,
Really?
and yeah, and it's shocking and it's tragic. And Man of Mountains isn't a suicide prevention charity, but for me, being outside, being able to get outside and be active and get into those places has helped me through my darkest times, you know. And I think everybody should have access to that. So the idea for the project came around, you know, trying to raise that money to also help us reach more people and scale as a charity, but also to raise awareness around that. And there was no way I was going to do that on my own. You know, it's a lot of money to try and raise. So the idea has been trying to inspire people, you know, encourage our community, individuals, organizations, and businesses to get involved, to set their own challenges. And we've had some people doing amazing things, you know, like cycling in a relay in a group, you know, to running across India, to climbing Penifan every week of the year last year for us. And that was,
Wow.
yeah, loads of things, and not always extreme. You know, everyone has their own challenges, and you know, getting young people involved in that as well. And I think I felt, as the founder of the charity, you know, I need to do my bit. I need to do my own challenges. And last year, I was quite busy trying to touch and run across the coast to coast. So I had attempt to run from St. Bees in Cumbria, in Robin Hood's Bay in Yorkshire. Now, that should have been my first of a few challenges as part of Project 500, but it didn't quite go to plan. In July, I had a seizure 78 miles into that first attempt. After 21 hours of running, my first seizure in 17 years. So now I can't drive for a year.
Oh no.
So I bought a bike, as you logically would in that situation, and I've been doing a lot on that. And I went back in August, and that attempt didn't quite go to plan either. Got to about 124 miles, but the route is 186 miles. So I went back in December to run the final 60 miles. But this year I want to go all in. I've come up with probably my daftest, most ridiculous challenge yet, because I want to mark my 30th. I want to mark 10 years since, you know, the avalanche on Everest and the earthquake, and find a challenge that's really going to push the boundaries and hopefully raise a lot of money. And The challenge is still in the process of being planned. It's not kind of, it's not out there yet. But when I do that, it's going to be in the UK. It's going to involve a lot of running and cycling and a record attempt. So really busy trying to get that off the ground. And just on the coaching as well, I know I mentioned before, but on the coaching, I really want to, take a step towards that. And I've started an ICF accredited integrative coaching diploma, which I'm really enjoying. And for me, it's just another way to help people. So I'm really keen to get that experience as well. So there's the two things really, fundraising and coaching.
No, sounds like you've got an awful lot going on, a brilliant charity and a brilliant cause. Best of luck with that. And if businesses wanted to get involved in supporting you, where do they go?
We'd love their support. We've raised over £150,000 already, and so we've got a good start, but there's a long way to go. So we really need people to join us, but also boost their own health and well-being in the process. The best place is to contact us on the website, mindofthemountains.org.uk. There's a page in there about Project 500, all the resources, all the info that people need to sign up and register, all free of charge. We just want to pe get people involved in their own ways. I mean, personally, I'm on all the kind of channels and social media. You can find me on LinkedIn and Instagram and TikTok, dare I say. I had to go down that road as well. But, I'm always happy to hear from people. If I can pay forward and share the things that I've learned and been taught, I'd love to hear from people as well. And feel free to contact me on any of those means and we can start a conversation.
Brilliant. I'll put all those details in the show notes as well. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been an amazing conversation.
Thank you all. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Rona, as well. And we'll see you all next time. Thank you for listening. We'd love to hear your opinion on the topics Alex, Rona and I discussed in this episode, and we'd also love to hear your thoughts on our Leading Gen Z white paper. You can download it for free by following the link in the show notes, and after you've read it, find us on LinkedIn by searching Inspirational Group and get involved with the conversation there. Alternatively, you can contact us via the website beinspirational.com or individually using the links in the show notes. We'll see you next time.